Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 4th of March. We have so much to talk about this hour with the author of a very important book titled America's Bitter Pill, Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. Stephen Brill is our guest. He's the author of the book he has written for The New Yorker, Time, The New York Times Magazine. He founded and ran Court TV, the American Lawyer Magazine, 10 regional legal newspapers. He is the author of Time's, you may have seen this, March 4, 2013 special report, Bitter Pill, Why Medical Bills Are Killing Us. That is the basis of the book that was released in January. He won the 2014 National Magazine Award for Public Interest. He teaches journalism at Yale, where he founded the Yale Journalism Initiative to encourage and enable talented young people to become journalists. The book looks at so many issues. It is a very detailed, behind-the-scenes account of the creation of Obamacare in this country, who the major players were, why there was not a public option, what was ultimately fashioned, who it benefits, why it may not have gone far enough, why it doesn't really address the cost of health care, which in this country was $3 trillion last year, the total health care bill, $3 trillion. He looks at the pharmaceutical companies in the world, and they're signing settlement agreements with federal prosecutors and charging what they charge more than any other country in the world, why that's the case. He looks at Chargemaster. How do we know, and how do hospitals determine what the charges are for any of the procedures? He does a detailed examination of that. And he also has personal experience. He made it out fine, but it was a frightening time for him as he was writing the book. He also had to undergo open heart surgery that was quite serious, and so he had he has a look at the fear element here, that we will spend any amount of money, put ourselves in bankruptcy so that we can save people who we love, and so that's a part of this whole conversation as well. As you can tell, we have a lot to talk about. And you are welcome to join this conversation as well. For your phone calls for Stephen, our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Stephen, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Oh, great to be with you. That was a long introduction. I hope I deserved it.
I think you did. Congratulations on the book. I mean, it's such a thorough examination. I've never read anything before that looks so carefully at Obamacare. And
well, I appreciate hearing that, and it's, you know, it's nice to see people are reading it. It's done pretty well.
Yeah,
I can't complain.
Right. Well, it's time for us to know the information. How are you? Are you feeling well?
Oh, I'm feeling fine. Absolutely fine.
Good.
What? Yeah, so much so that one of my kids accused me of engaging in a sort of over-the-top act of undercover reporting when I had that open heart surgery.
No. <Yeah. laughs> But you said it wasn't true. I wish I didn't have to go through that. I'm sure that it was hard.
You bet.
Yeah. Well, let's start with the pharmaceutical industry for a moment, if you don't mind, because the cost of prescription drugs, and it's my understanding that nobody's really investigated, and I hope you do a book on this next. You look at why they are so astronomically high. You look at the fines they've had to pay and the legal settlements they've had to make with federal prosecutors. It's an industry that seems wildly unregulated. Why are all of our pharmaceutical bills so much more than any other country on earth?
Because we don't regulate the prices. We are the only country, the only developed country in the world that doesn't regulate the price of prescription drugs, where, you know, someone has a patent, so that by definition, a patent is a monopoly. And if you have a patent on a drug that cures cancer or cures hepatitis C, the good news is that it's great that you spent all the money to, you know, either to buy the company that owned the drug or to develop it yourself. But the bad news is not only are you allowed to make very good profits and very good profit margins the way you are in Europe or Asia, you're allowed to make exorbitant profits. You're basically allowed to charge anything you want. And the patient has no choice because you're the only game in town. You have the only drug that can cure that patient's cancer.
Mm-hmm. And you hear from the pharmaceutical industry, well, in America, of course we have to charge more because we do all the world's research and development. You show that they don't spend all that much on research and development.
No, they spend a relatively small percentage of their revenue on research and development. Most of the major drug companies spend more on marketing than they do on research and development. And they're not even necessarily companies based in the United States. So wherever they do that research and development is not here. They can just charge a lot more money here than they charge in France or Germany or the UK. And, you know, of course, the other question is, who signed up Americans? You know, assuming their argument was true, which it's not, the question would be, who signed up Americans to subsidize the cost of drugs in every other country in the world when the biggest financial crisis we face in this country is the cost of health care? It's bankrupting the Treasury, and it's gradually bankrupting all the middle-class families in this country.
Mm-hmm. Who made the decision that Medicare would not be able to negotiate prices with pharmaceutical companies?
A bunch of Democrats and Republicans in Congress who were heavily lobbied by the pharmaceutical industry. The healthcare industry as a whole spends 4.5 times as much lobbying as the next largest industry. The other great example might be the medical device industry, which is, you know, very big in your state. And as part of the Affordable Care Act, as part of Obamacare, as I write in the book, a tax of 3% was added to every sale that they make. And since then, the healthcare, the medical device makers have been complaining that this has killed jobs and it's killed their profits, when in fact it does nothing of the kind because, again, you know, adding, you know, 3% to the cost of a, you know, of a pacemaker means nothing to anybody except to the insurance companies that have to pay for it, but you can do it. And the bottom line is that Medtronic, which is perhaps the leading device maker, headquartered in Minnesota, since Obamacare was signed and since that tax went into effect, their profits are up 67%.
Wow.
And they've added 5,000 people to the payroll. So it's hard to argue that it's a profit killer or a jobs killer. And yet Democrats and Republicans alike seem poised to repeal that tax because they've been so heavily lobbied. You know, even, you know, supposed, you know, liberals like, you know, the sainted Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts, where they have a big device industry, or Al Franken in Minnesota, are pushing for that tax to be repealed. And there's just no reason for it to be repealed. Those device makers got tens of millions of new customers because of Obamacare, mm-hmm. and because of the way Obamacare provides subsidies for people to buy health insurance, which enables those patients to buy those devices.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned hepatitis C. What's the name of that drug? Salvati? Is that it?
Salvati.
Salvati.
Yes.
Tell us the story of Salvati.
Well, it's made by a company called Gilead, which bought the company that developed the drug. And when they bought the company that developed the drug, their financials in justifying the purchase said that they were going to charge something like, you know, $300 or $400 for each pill. Once they bought the drug, they decided, well, gee, we're the only game in town, at least right now we are. So, you know, the heck with it. Let's just charge $1,000 a pill. And they charge $1,000 a pill. And just that bill for those pills, because hepatitis is a disease, you know, that so many Americans suffer from, and it's a great pill. It really works. Let's stipulate that. But just that $1,000 pill is responsible in California for the state paying in Medicaid payments prospectively as much as the state supplies in aid to education to all the public schools in California, just for that pill.
Mm. And so they're
that's unsustainable.
Yeah.
You know, we can't go on like that.
They're charging it just because they can charge that much.
Yeah, I mean, and the best evidence, of course, is that they're charging $1,000 a pill, not $989.29, not $1,011. So what that tells you is that they probably decided on the price as, two guys were walking to the men's room and said, well, what do you think we should charge? And the other guy said, well, how about $1,000? Sounds good to me. I mean, keeping that big round number is emblematic of the total lack of regulation we have in this country when it comes to drug prices.
Isn't it amazing that all the Democrats and Republicans, everybody sits down and comes to the table, people from different political persuasions, they hash it out, they fight it out, they debate it for years and years. We finally get some bill, but nobody really looks. We get more insurance for a lot of people, but as you say at some point, the bumper sticker should say more middle class and poor people get to get health insurance, but they pay the same prices. You know, it's still as expensive as ever. Why didn't anybody really look at that?
Oh, no, they looked at it. They were just, there was an orgy of lobbying. I mean, every single corner of the healthcare industry, from, kidney dialysis makers to, arthritis drugs to, everything, everybody was swarming this bill. And in Washington, what passes for reform in 2010, but it's obviously true now, what passes for reform are the laws that, the most powerful interest in Washington will allow to be passed.
Mm-hmm.
The drug companies like Obamacare because it basically creates tens of millions of new customers to buy their, exorbitantly priced products. Same thing with the hospitals, the so-called nonprofit hospitals. Are just making a lot more money now than they were even before because all these new patients are showing up who have health insurance, which is a good thing, but the law does nothing to control the prices that hospitals charge, mm-hmm. nothing to control how they bill, nothing to control the exorbitant salaries that their CEOs make.
Another thing that you highlight so skillfully is you've traveled and talked to so many people who've been victims of charges that really seem, Stephen, to be somewhat willy-nilly. And even when you talked to people, when you interviewed people, it was hard to figure out why certain charges were made. If you look at a bill, well, how did you come up with this MRI?
No one can explain. They vary totally across the board. There's no consistency, and there's also no correlation to quality. You get a knee replacement at Hospital A versus Hospital B, the cost could be two or three times as much, but, the data say that there's no difference in quality. Or there could be a difference, but if it is, it's purely a coincidence. And the core reason this happens is that you have a system that is totally unaccountable. And the reason it's unaccountable is it's not like any other marketplace. If you and I, decide today, I think my smartphone is a little out of date. I think I'm going to, see if I should buy a new one. We'd go to the Verizon store, we'd go to Apple, we'd go to Consumer Reports to see what they say about what's the best deal on a smartphone. And at the end of the day, we'll know which one we want to buy, or more importantly, we can say to ourselves, they're both too expensive. I think I'll stick with the one I have. You don't get any of that kind of decision-making in healthcare. You have no idea what you're buying. You have no idea what the quality is. You have no idea what the price is going to be before you buy it. When you get the bill, you have no idea what the cost was because the bill is unintelligible. The only thing you know is that you were sick or your loved one was sick and you wanted to get better.
Absolutely. You tell this story, and let's highlight it, at least a few of them during this hour, of a woman who's a bus driver. I think she's somewhere in Connecticut, and she falls down on the ice and gets this really bad nosebleed, and she has to go to the hospital, and they do stitches, and they do some CT scans, and she's got insurance, but it's not the best of insurance coverage, and she winds up with a whopping, I think, $7,000 that she has to pay, and which right. almost sends her back to the hospital in shock. $7,000, I don't have this.
Right, for 2 or 3 hours waiting in the emergency room and being looked at by a doctor for 15 minutes, getting a couple of CAT scans that she probably didn't need. The hospital, Yale New Haven Hospital, It was actually Bridgeport Hospital, but Yale New Haven owns it as part of the rampant consolidation going on around the country of hospital systems. They billed her. You're right, she had insurance that wasn't really insurance. In fact, it was the kind of insurance that Obamacare has now outlawed. And that's the kind of insurance that, you know, when the president said, if you like your insurance, you can keep your insurance, this woman, who is a school bus driver making $38,000 a year, she liked that insurance until she needed it. So mm-hmm. if she had heard that Obama was canceling her insurance before she ended up in the emergency room, she would have been angry. But as she found out, that insurance covered her for only the first $2,000 of her $7,000 or $8,000 bill. And she now could buy insurance on the exchanges that would cover her completely at a lower cost than she was paying for that bad insurance. But, you know, to come back to Yale New Haven, they had all kinds of, you know, charges on that bill that were just off the wall.
So it would come out better for her in terms of what she would have to pay out of pocket, but somebody else is still paying the same amount.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
We welcome phone calls, and we'll start taking them momentarily. Our guest this hour is Stephen Brill. Stephen is the author of the recently published and really comprehensive on so many levels book about America's healthcare system. It's America's Bitter Pill, Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. It has a very extensive, and I don't know anybody else who's done a thorough examination of how the Affordable Care Act came into being, who was at the table, who was lobbying, why the bill in its current form is the way that it is, were there things that were thought of that would have made it more efficient and they were discarded for some reason, and what might that be? I also want to ask Stephen about the Supreme Court deliberations that are going on today. It would indicate that the challenge to the Affordable Care Act based on subsidies, federal subsidies, may not win, but he may see it another way. It looks like Kennedy is questioning pretty toughly. But how that found its way to the Supreme Court, we can talk about that. And whatever issues you want to discuss, why is it that with all of this years and years of debate on the healthcare system, we may have more people insured, but we still have this incredibly expensive system? Why is that? Why doesn't anybody look at the cost of everything? How can people not exactly know what's a fair market price for a pill for hepatitis or for a CAT scan or an MRI or an aspirin? 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where we're happy to receive your messages and read them on the air, is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stephen Brill is with us now. Our phone lines are filled. I imagine they would be, so just keep trying. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we start our calls with Eric in Milwaukee. Hi, Eric.
Hi, good afternoon, Ms. Dunn. Thank you for taking my call, and good afternoon, Mr. Brill. I'm a Marine Corps veteran, and I'm very satisfied with the services provided to me by the VA hospital, and I was very much disappointed with the exclusion of the public option. I was very disappointed, and I'm hoping that you can discuss that and maybe share where's the public outcry amongst religious leaders concerning the moral issue of the profiteering off of health care, and perhaps understand maybe in the 70s was when that shift really occurred, and I'll be happy to take your answer off the phone.
Thanks, Eric. What happened to the public option?
What happened to the public option goes back to all the lobbying power that I explained. The insurance companies, were dead set against it because, that would be competition from them. And if the public option created a government-backed insurance company that could pay lower rates and charge lower rates, it would drive the insurance companies out of business, which you and I and the caller might think is a good thing, but if you're one of the millions of people who works in the private insurance industry, you don't think it's such a good thing. And, you know, this comes back to a basic point of the book, that money and and lobbyists have really taken over policymaking in Washington to an extent that I don't think anyone can remember. And, you know, the caller wakes up in the morning and worries about a lot of things, you know, through his day. Obviously, if he was in the Marine Corps, he worries about a lot of really important things through his day. If you're paid by the healthcare industry to lobby in Washington and this law is being talked about and being drafted, you wake up in the morning and you only worry about one thing, and that is, how do I keep this law from hurting the people who are paying me or helping the people who are paying me? And it's only going to be when the public rises up and cares more or as much as the lobbyists that elected officials will listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's that simple.
And, Stephen, what did the president really think about the public option?
Well, I think he thought deep down that, you know, that there should be a public option. But let's remember, the public option as it was being talked about, it was never clear that it was going to be the panacea. It's not like creating, you know, Medicare for everybody, where the government, you know, buys the services and, you know, buys them inexpensively so that there aren't exorbitant profits. The public option was in different drafts, was a nonprofit sponsored by the government that would have to pay the same prices that the insurance companies paid, which, of course, would make the whole thing totally beside the point, because the insurance companies get gouged by the hospitals. The public option insurance company would. In the iterations of the draft of the public option where they could pay what Medicare pays, that's the one that the insurance companies said, we'll move heaven and earth not to let that happen. And obviously the drug companies and the hospitals agreed with them because that would cut off their profits.
And what do you make of Eric's point that there's something immoral here, that millions are being made by pharmaceutical companies, insurers, hospitals, off our health?
Well, there's an argument, a good argument, I think, that drug companies have to be allowed to make good profits because that gives them the incentive to go hire, you know, chemists and researchers and biologists and computer software programmers who can invent new drugs. And they've invented a ton of new treatments that save a lot of lives. And, you know, and some people will do that because they want to get rich. And in this country, there's nothing wrong with rewarding that. What is wrong is to have those profits be so far and away beyond what any other country does. I mean, you don't need to have the price of a drug in the United States be 50 to 100% higher than it is in Germany for new drugs to be developed, because the drugs are very profitable to the pharmaceutical companies in Germany. So leaving, you know, the morality side of it out, if you just look at it as a practical matter, what you need to do is control that. And if you simply said, well, no one's going to be able to make any profit off of people getting sick, you know, you never would have invented the MRI or the CAT scan. You would never have people, you know, nurses, you know, working in a hospital. You wouldn't have people making nurses' uniforms. So I think that's going a little too far, but that doesn't negate the caller's basic point, which is, in this country, we have taken that to a point where it arguably is immoral. If you have the CEO of a drug company, as I recount in the book, who's making $20 million a year, and there's a guy standing downstairs in the lobby of the MD Anderson Cancer Center hoping to get his first transfusion of that drug, but he can't because his $83,000 check hasn't cleared, which he needs to pay for, among other things.
I know.
A $13,700 bill just for that one transfusion that cost that drug company $200, that's over the top.
Yes, it is. Claudia is next in Eau Claire. Hi, Claudia.
Good afternoon, Kathleen. Thank you very much for taking my call. I'm very interested in this topic. I was diagnosed with a form of leukemia that is treated with an oral cancer drug called Gleevec. And that was back in 2004. And at that time, the drug cost about $2,400 a month. My last bill last month was almost $11,000
for a 30-day supply.
And when I did a little research, I found out that as far as research and development went, most of the research done on Gleevec was done, paid for by the Leukemia Lymphoma Society and a couple of other foundations. And now I found out it was supposed to go off patent in 2015. Now it's not going off till sometime in 2016. And, you know, the price just keeps going up and up and up and up, and I don't know what people are supposed to do.
What are you doing? How much do you have to pay, Claudia?
I'm on Medicare, so I have the Part D, which means I pay the famous donut hole. And then in addition to that, once you get past that in January and February, then it's 5% of the rest of the cost. And
yeah, which
that
is
keeps going up every month.
Yeah, now that's a horrendous cost, but remember, the taxpayers are paying the other 95%. So your experience perfectly summarizes the crisis we face, which is individual families can't afford health care as we know it in this country, and the taxpayers can't afford it. On the other hand, let's remember, this drug is saving your life. So saying that they ought to give it away for free might make sense, except if drug companies had to give all their drugs away for free, they wouldn't be in business and wouldn't be developing drugs. So there has to be some middle road. And when you say that the patent is being extended, those are the kinds of arrangements that the courts are now finally starting to look at, and the regulators are, which is what kind of deal was made that allows them to extend that patent beyond where it's supposed to be extended.
Is there any drug that could possibly, in research and development and rare ingredients, be a fair price for it to be $11,000 a month?
Well, you almost said be worth $11,000.
Right.
And I'm certain to the caller that drug is worth $11,000
sure.
a month. The question is whether anybody has the wherewithal to pay $11,000 a month for it. And then the second question, your question, is whether there's any justifiable
reason
argument for charging $11,000. And the only argument that that can be made for charging $11,000 is we can, and the customer has to pay it because there's nothing stopping us from doing it.
Eric writes this, my daughter and I are Austrian citizens living in the U.S. Last year, my daughter needed a prescription for a pain medication for menstrual cramps. She was absolutely shocked when she found out that the exact same pill she gets in Europe for €8, about $10, would have been $400 here. She declined, and I got it for her in Austria.
Well, that just says exactly what I've been saying. I mean, and believe me, they're making money on it in Austria.
Right. Let's go to some of this came to you, I think, when you went through your own experience with your heart, that you come up with another idea for how to, I don't know if it would substantially lower health care costs or, but tell us what your big idea is from having spent so much time investigating the health industry.
Well, what I've seen is something that's going on, and it's going on in Wisconsin, it's going on everywhere, which is prominent hospitals are expanding and expanding. They're consolidating, they're buying up other hospitals, they're buying up laboratories, clinics, doctors' practices. So they themselves have, in effect, their own network. And that's not a good thing at first look because it eliminates competition. The example I use in the book is the Yale New Haven Hospital in New Haven, Connecticut, which the Yale New Haven healthcare system is gradually getting larger than Yale University, which is the Yale that everyone associates with New Haven, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
They own the doctors and all the hospitals around and the clinics, and prices have shot up. Now, what I suggest is that, well, you know, there should have been some a regulatory enforcement in the first place to stop that consolidation, but in a way that consolidation could become a good thing, Because if you allowed and encouraged Yale New Haven to sell its own health insurance, which a lot of these systems are starting to do, the Cleveland Clinic is starting to do it, there are some large hospital systems that now sell their own health insurance, and indeed there's a big system originally based in California that's been doing it for years.
Kaiser Permanente.
So if they sold their own health insurance, let's say I lived in New Haven, I'd give Yale New Haven $10,000 a year, which is probably what my employer gives, pays my current health insurance company. And I'd give them $10,000 a year, my employer would, and say, all right, you're my insurance company, you keep me healthy. If I get sick, I'll go to a Yale New Haven doctor. If I need a blood test, it'll be done at a Yale New Haven lab. If I go to the hospital, it'll be at Yale New Haven. And I don't want to know what any of that costs because I've given you $10,000 and you take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
The advantage of that is that the biggest problem with healthcare costs is overbilling. It's the hospital charging $77 for a box of gauze pads or having, you know, 4 blood tests a day when they only need 2 or having a CAT scan when you don't need it. Well, that kind of overbilling, the incentive for that would go away because if Yale New Haven does an unnecessary CAT scan, the bill goes to Yale New Haven because it's the insurance company. So there's no point in doing that. So that's the good news. But that only works if you take those monopolies or oligopolies and you regulate them heavily, because if Yale New Haven did that and said, we're going to take our insurance but nobody else's insurance, they could charge whatever they wanted for the insurance because they're the only game in town. So my suggestion is that you allow these big hospital systems to sell their own insurance into their own systems, but you regulate their prices and their profits and everything else associated with that the way the government regulates other monopolies and other oligopolies to make sure that they don't take advantage of all the leverage they have.
Mm-hmm. And from your conversations with CEOs of these places, are they okay with that kind of regulation?
They say so in theory. The question is, you know, there are two questions. One is, would they be okay with it in practice? And the second, more important question is, would the regulators actually regulate? Because the history of regulation in this country generally, and the history of regulation of healthcare in particular, is it's usually pretty weak, and the regulators are all too often captured by the people they're supposed to be regulating.
It's always something, huh?
Yep.
Yeah. Peg in Menominee. Hi. Hi, Peg.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Oh, I'm calling about the price of my premium. I'm retired from state worker from the state of Wisconsin. I live in Menominee, Michigan, and we pay $19.29 a month for health insurance. I've been going around with them since the beginning of the year because I haven't gotten my bills in time to pay them on time. And yesterday I got a past due notice for the bills I had paid with my own invoice. And, you know, it's just a lot of little things going wrong. And I asked them, if it's $700 for one, why is it $1,900 for two? And they said, because you're on the family plan. I said, but it should be $1,400 for two. I said, if I had five kids, it would be
$1,900. Yeah.
And their response was, well, the actuaries have figured it out, and this is what they have has come to be. And I have looked in the marketplace, and what I would get there would cost me more for less. So we haven't left the state's insurance. But it's $23,000 a year, and we don't qualify for any subsidies because we have to take the money out of our IRAs to pay our health insurance.
Stephen.
Well, you've identified something that I talk about a lot in the book, which is the utter irrationality and unaccountability of the system. I'll tell you a health insurance story that beats the one you have. As I recount in the book, after I got out of the hospital from this open-heart surgery, when I was home for 2 or 3 days, I got in the mail 36 different first-class envelopes from UnitedHealthcare, my insurance company. And each of those 36 envelopes was a different explanation of benefits for some different thing, a drug, the surgeon's bill, the anesthesiologist, the hospital stay, all these different things, Oh, and by the way, getting 36 different first-class envelopes the same day to the same place from the same sender tells you something about the efficiency of the system. So I start opening up these envelopes. When I get to the third one, it says, this is the explanation of benefits, and we all get explanations of benefits, right? The third one says, amount billed, zero. Amount paid by insurance, zero. Amount you owe, $154.20.
Oh, no.
And I look at that, my wife looks at it, and we can't figure it out. Well, as it happened, before I'd gone into the hospital, I had scheduled an interview for the book with the CEO of UnitedHealthcare, which is headquartered in Minnesota. And so when I was able to travel, I went out there to see him, and we had, you know, we spent about an hour together. I asked him about all the lobbying they had done over Obamacare, how Obamacare was going to affect the insurance industry, all that great stuff. And then at the end, I said, I'm wondering if you could help me with something. And I took that explanation of benefits out of my, out of the pocket of my suit jacket and handed it to him and said, can you explain what this means? And he looked at it, and he looked at it, and he looked at it. Finally, he looked up and said, I could sit here all day, and I couldn't explain this to you. I have no idea what it means. I don't know why they sent it to you. And I said, well, aren't you they?
Right, aren't you they?
Now step back and think about it. That is, you know, health care is the largest industry in what we think of as the most vibrant, wonderful, accountable, free market economy in the world. Healthcare is the largest industry. The most frequent consumer communication that providers send to customers in that industry is the insurance company's explanation of benefits, right? We see them all the time. They send out hundreds of millions of these documents every year to people. And here, the CEO of the largest healthcare company in the world, the largest health insurance company, a highly regarded guy, very good guy, he doesn't understand what that communication means. How are the rest of us supposed to understand it?
Well, maybe your visit will change all that, Stephen.
Could be.
Maybe.
Who knows?
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. This hour, our guest is Stephen Brill. Stephen is the author of America's Bitter Pill, Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And Twitter is @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls for Stephen. Our next caller is Mike in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. I just wanted to ask about the very regressive nature of the fine. The way it's worded, it says you pay a flat fee or a percentage of income, and it says whichever is greater. So I know in 2016 when the fine goes up to $695 per person, that would require an uninsured couple to pay actually over 6% of their income towards the fine, where somebody making, you know, more would only pay 2%.
Well, it depends on what the uninsured couple's income is.
Right. The way I did a thing, it's $22,000 if they earn, they'll pay $1,390, and if they earn $75,000, they have the same fine. So the lower income person is paying three times more.
I'm not following your math. Well, first of all, $22,000. Dollar a year person would qualify for subsidies, for such deep subsidies that they'd probably get the insurance for free.
And you would for quite a bit of money up from $22,000. Wouldn't you get some kind of subsidy?
Up to like $92,000.
Wow. Oh, it's that high.
Yeah.
Well, we need to talk about the Supreme Court for a moment. How did this case ever make its way to the Supreme Court? And do you have any inkling where they're from their questioning today where they're likely to go?
Well, there's been a lot of, you know, talk about how it made its way, and this is a case about, you know, some wording where the opponents of Obamacare are saying that the legislators who wrote the law specifically intended to penalize states that did not set up their own exchanges, and the way they would penalize the states was they were not going to give subsidies to citizens of that state who nonetheless had to sign up for health insurance. when the issue is what the legislators intended, that's a fact-based issue. And it turns out I had a catbird seat to understand that issue because I did all my reporting about how the law was conceived, how it was drafted, how it was written, before this case ever became anything prominent. So in with everybody I talked to, in every email I saw, every internal memo I saw, it was crystal clear that they meant for the federal exchange, which would be established in states that didn't set up their own exchange, that the federal exchange would apply, that the subsidies would apply. So for me, who's actually done, you know, the research and was there before anybody had a dog in that fight because there wasn't any fight, this is a completely bogus case.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
so, yes.
Whether the justices will see it the same way is a whole other story, and I think, you know, the consensus is that it's a toss-up.
Well, why didn't they see it as bogus? Why would they even take it?
You tell me.
All right. No, you
not for any legal reason I can see.
Yeah.
Not for any good non-political reason,
I see.
Shall we say.
Okay. Dakota is next in Ashland. Hi.
Hi. I've got a comment and then a question. I agree with one of the callers you had earlier. Don't think it's moral for people to be making this kind of money to, you know, say that I can get better if I'm sick or prevent me from dying. But then not necessarily don't think doctors or nurses should get paid. They can get paid. That's fine. That makes sense to me. But then I don't agree with the guest in that there would be no incentive for this stuff to get done. People become nurses because they want to help people, help the sick. If you're a chemist and you're making these drugs, you're interested in the science, and you want to help cure cancer, sure, they're going to get paid. They're doing a great thing, a hard thing to do, but they're also motivated in that way. And my question is, do you think we can change our whole system altogether and maybe have something more socialist like they do in European countries where it's all taken care of, we pay more in taxes, but everybody gets the best care?
Universal health care. Is that ever a possibility here, Stephen?
Well, it's possible, but the 2 points. First of all, we would not have to pay more in taxes if we did something about the prices. Again, all the other countries in the world spend far less on health care per person, providing it to everybody, than we do in this country, because here the prices are so ridiculously high. The second point is, in Europe, I mean, there is no place where there is socialized pharmaceutical care. The drug companies are for-profit companies. They make money, but the prices are just inordinately lower everywhere else than here, because the attitude of those other countries is you can make a very good profit, but you can't fleece people. Here, there's no such control.
Here's an email from Martha. Stephen, is there any legislation being proposed that would sort out the health care issues, or are our politicians so in the hip pockets of the profiteers that the outlook is bleak?
I think, the best evidence from my book is the outlook's bleak.
All right. Guy in Lilly. Hi.
Hi. I had a couple of questions, actually, as I was listening to you guys. The first one was, I understand members of Congress and our senators and that are privy to a special type of health care. They don't belong to the same type of health care system as the rest of us. And I was kind of wondering why that is. Why do they get special privilege? And the second question was...
That's just not true.
...to eliminate the middleman.
You may understand it, but you're probably understanding it from Fox News. It's just not true.
It's not true. Guy, what's question number...
annual income.
Guy, what's... Guy, what's question number two?
Question number two is, why couldn't they eliminate the middleman, the insurance companies, and just pay a portion of my income directly to the medical community?
Okay.
Well, that's the idea I have at the end of the book, where you'd pay, you'd pay for insurance from, the large healthcare system in your community, not from an insurance, not provided by an insurance company, which, as you say, eliminates the middleman.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that the Affordable Care Act, that one of the primary writers was a woman whose mother had to take an $8.50 an hour job at an airport, even though her doctor was her husband was a retired doctor, because she had a pre-existing condition, and that's factored heavily into the writing of this. What about all of those people you have interviewed, all of the people in this country who have had all their savings wiped out, or who can band together in some way to take on the issue of the cost of health care, which has not yet been addressed? There have to be millions and millions of people in this country who would support an examination of the whole industry.
Well, there are millions and millions. They support it, but again, they don't wake up every day fighting for it. And lobbyists wake up every day fighting for it.
Well, they could have candidates to vote for who would fight for it.
They could, but, you know, it hasn't worked, not yet, because those candidates, members of Congress rely heavily in this day and age on campaign contributions, and the healthcare industry contributes more money to candidates than any other industry. And I'm sorry, but it's just that simple. And people who, you know, support single payer, for example, you know, Medicare for all, they're just not as riled up about it, for the most part, as a guy who is paid by a drug company or a medical device maker to lobby Al Franken for it.
Let's take one more phone call. We're almost at the end of the hour. Florence in Choma. Hi, Florence.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to speak a little to the history of this. My husband was a practicing physician in the 50s and 60s. And of course, we have to consider inflation, too. But his office calls were $3.
Oh.
His house calls were $5. And a delivery of a baby was $100.
Oh, my.
Including all prenatal and postnatal care.
Hmm. Wow.
But, of course, you multiply that times 10, it would be 50 and 30. But what I'm saying is that when the insurance companies came in, the prices immediately jumped. And because people didn't really know what they were paying, and they charged the prices for everything just jumped, doubled.
Right, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit of history is in order here. We went down the path we went, which is a different path than every other country in the world, because of a little-known event during World War II. There was a board established by President Roosevelt called the War Labor Board, which was in charge of enforcing wage and price controls during World War II. And lots of employers were trying to figure out a way that they could increase wages to lure workers without looking like they were increasing wages. So they came up with this idea that they would offer this thing called health insurance.
Mm.
And during the 1940s, health care was starting to become a semi-significant expense because we had developed health care. You know, there were penicillin pills. There were things you could do in a hospital other than, you know, waiting for people to die.
20 seconds left.
So once the government, the World Labor Board, said, okay, health insurance doesn't count as a wage increase, employers started providing it, and that's what built up the private health insurance companies, and that's pretty much how we got where we are today.
Yeah. Stephen, thank you so much for writing the book and all
Happy
the work
to do
you've
it.
Done. Thank you. Appreciated
well,
the
thank
hour.
Thank you.
Stephen Brill, the book is America's Bitter Pill, Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. Stephen has written for a number of prominent publications, and his cover story on Time Magazine 2013 is the basis of this very worthwhile book. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for production of the show. Thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee.